91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we get the latest info about social media and the law from attorney Ethan Wall. If there were doubters, the influence illustrated by President Trump's tweets being considered evidence in a federal travel ban appellate court ruling is obvious. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Attorney Ethan Wall is a faculty member at Nova Southeastern University. He knows the ropes in the rather new field of social media law and advises clients about often unforeseen legal risks. Those deemed to be social media influencers like Jennifer Lopez, the Kardashians, or those of lesser fame are warned to disclose brand relationships when touting products on Twitter. What about convicted sex offenders? Do they have constitutional rights to a Facebook page? We'll be taking your call, Topical Currents and Social Media, next after the news. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Today we cover legal issues pertaining to social media and networking. We're joined now by attorney Ethan Wall, who's a frequent go-to expert on a subject which continues to evolve.
He teaches law at Nova Southeastern University Law School and has written books on the topic, including the titles Fire Over Facebook and The Social Media Guide for Lawyers.
And there's even more. His consulting firm is Social Media Law and Order, and last year he was a finalist for a Hype Award from the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce.
Ethan Wall is with us for the hour, and of course we'll take your questions. Welcome. Always great to see you, Ethan.
Great to be back.
Okay, there are so many great subjects today. So let's start with the president's tweets and the larger implications, which is social media evidence. As you pointed out, his tweets were recently featured in that appellate court order refusing to implement his revised travel ban. So let's delve into that.
We are at an unprecedented time with the use of social media by our president and by the government. While the Barack Obama administration was really the first administration to start testing social media as a messaging tool, we have our president tweeting about current events, issues, his personal opinions on different areas of law. And it's creating a real ruckus in the legal space as to what extent these tweets can be used as evidence and how they are impacting big current events like our current immigration situation here in the United States.
Okay, so you write that the administration was then sued when they sought to force Twitter to reveal the identity of users who were criticizing the president's immigration policy. So first of all, I mean, that's very scary as in freedom of speech. It's also very scary in freedom of the press. And it's scary in, like, where are we living? Do you remember Nixon's enemy list?
Yes.
Is that, I know it's before your time, but did you ever hear of that?
Of course.
But where are we living that you can't dislike his immigration policies?
This is a brave new world. Aldous Huxley couldn't imagine this when he was writing that book several years ago. So what's happening with the issue of Twitter and freedom of speech and the president? We have different members of governmental agencies creating what are called alternative Twitter accounts, meaning alt-labor or alt-environment. So these are accounts that are created by people within the administration themselves, employees who have knowledge about what's happening with the governmental entities, but they're not official accounts, but they're commenting on what they believe is a misuse of government assets or an incorrect policy that the president is pushing. And so because President Trump and the current administration didn't like to see these Twitter accounts talking bad about their immigration policy, they filed a subpoena through Customs and Border Patrol to Twitter seeking to get the identity of these anonymous Twitter accounts so they could go after these people who are speaking out against the administration.
And
as a result of this, Twitter stepped in and actually sued the Department of Homeland Security. They said, you don't have a right under the law to reveal the identity of anonymous Twitter account users. And the basis of that opinion is because political speech has always been a really, really strong protection under the First Amendment.
Right.
And the government can't use its subpoena tools, its investigatory powers, to identify or force companies to identify anonymous people who are making political speech on social media simply because they don't like what they're saying.
Just like you'd need a warrant in a criminal investigation for phone records.
Exactly. Just in the way the police can't just come into your house for no reason at all,
right,
and start soliciting or eliciting comments or taking your things and then trying to find a crime later. The government can't say, we don't like what you're saying online. And even though you haven't committed a crime, we want to know who you are so that we can chill or interfere with people's ability to engage in protected speech.
Could Twitter have either A, decided to provide the identities had they wanted to, or B, been forced to provide them? I mean, could they have ruled in a court of law that, yes, they have to provide these identities?
That was very well possible. So let's see, why did Twitter object in the first place? The reason that Twitter objected and didn't turn over the identity of these users is because Twitter knows that the moment that they start cooperating with the government to turn over the identity of their users, people are going to stop tweeting.
Right.
There's Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, MySpace, if people are still using that, all these different platforms that people can use to communicate. And so Twitter knows we need to stand up and protect our users so that they feel comfortable using our platform to convey very important political messages. And so by stepping up and making this objection and demonstrating to both the courts and the administration that there was no legal grounds that the government had to reveal these Twitter users, the Department of Homeland Security withdrew their subpoena and the identity of these Twitter users were not revealed.
Twitter must be happy that the president uses it so frequently.
Of course, that the president's tweeting.
It makes the office so much more informal without having to go through the normal chains of releasing information.
Well, but it also can be releasing false information.
Well, I wonder if Lincoln would have pared down 47 years ago to fit into 140 characters.
Well, it was short as it was, Joe. Written on the back of an envelope, was it?
He would have redone his famous speech to say, if I had more time, I would have wrote a shorter tweet.
So staying with social media, in as much as it is replacing traditional media outlets, it doesn't distinguish between fact and fiction. So that's another frightening scenario. Are there not legal implications if fake news is being generated and it's known to be fake?
Well, if news is known to be fake, then there certainly can be legal repercussions with sharing the information. The question becomes, one, who decides what news is real and what news is fake, and who is ultimately responsible for making sure that the information that is posted on Facebook, for example, is going to be true.
So who is it?
Well, Facebook says it's not us, and they have a really good legal basis for doing so. There are federal laws that protect internet service providers from actions of what people take on their particular website. And so from Facebook, for example, mm-hmm. saying we have now, as of this week, 2 billion users. It would be impossible for Facebook to review every single type of, quote, news, close quote, related post to verify whether it's true or not. And the law doesn't require Facebook to do so. And so what Facebook is doing is they're voluntarily stepping up and saying, we're going to start implementing some new technology within Facebook that will allow users to flag what they believe are fake news stories. And then these flagged stories will be reviewed by an independent fact-checking review council that Facebook brings in, and that once a story has been flagged as fake news, users will be notified of that before they share a story. So let's say, for example, that Joe posts a story online, maybe similar to the one that CNN shared this week about ties between Russia
right.
and the Trump administration. And 1,000 people are flagging the story as fake, and it's much higher than all of the other flags that people might get on a particular post. And so it's determined that Joe's post was, in fact, fake news, as decided by the numbers and the review board. When Bonnie then goes to share that story on Facebook, she's going to be notified to say, this story has been flagged as fake news. Do you still want to share it? And so that's how Facebook is trying
but
to
But could I
the
say
issue.
Yes?
Oh, of course. Definitely. And there's really nothing that would prevent anybody from saying something fake online. And so the question is, who's responsible and who, at the end of the day, is in the best position to try to make sure that the information that is shared online is news? Because if you were to ask me 5 years ago, what's a news source? Well, I would say I'd go to WLRN or NPR, Washington Post, CNN, Fox News, depending
upon The
New York Times, Huffington Post. Now, people go directly to Facebook right. for their news. In fact, I go directly to Facebook for the news. Why? Why would I go to NPR and AP News and CNN and Fox News to get different stories when I can just follow them on Facebook anyway and receive the updates as part of my normal Facebook consumption experience? And so Facebook now has become, in a way, viewed as a news source, especially for people in the millennial generations.
But it's really just a form of Reader's Digest.
Exactly.
A compilation.
Well, what should the judicial system be doing? Shouldn't they be doing something about this?
A lot of people are stepping in and they're looking to the judicial system for answers and say lawyers or judges should be more involved in helping to solve the problem of fake news. And it is a problem
right.
across the board. The question is it the judicial branch's responsibility to proactively step in and try to find a solution or to be reactive once a problem arises? And that's really the question of separation of powers. So we have a really big issue from the government right now between the executive branch, which is designed to enforce the laws. We have the legislative branch that makes the laws and the judicial branch whose job is to interpret the laws. And so if we have judges or attorneys who are stepping up and saying, we're going to proactively try to change the issue of fake news, they may be overstepping their boundaries because mm-hmm. that's not their role or responsibility. And instead, it's the legislature that looks to make laws that could help fix the fake news problem once and for all.
Okay. We're going to continue our conversation with attorney, author, social media legal expert, consultant, adjunct professor of social media and the law, Nova Southeastern University, Ethan Wall. And we'll come back. We'll open the phones, too. Stay with us.
And we're back with Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, our Wednesday edition with attorney Ethan Wall. We're talking about social media and the law. A quick correction, Ethan Wall has actually won an award from the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce called a Hype Award, so we are duly corrected.
He was the Entrepreneur of the Year, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And if you'd like to join in our discussion with Ethan Wall, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, please keep them short, radio@WLRN.org. And a quick disclaimer, any advice that attorney Ethan Wall is giving today is purely for informational purposes and not answers to specific legal questions.
Okay, so I want to go back to the judicial system, what it should be doing or shouldn't be doing, and how it can be undermined now by social media. For example, okay, so we know now that tweets can be admissible, correct?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. But you know how often you hear that things were not admissible in court, and that's determined by?
By our legal evidentiary rules. And so let's walk through the evolution of social media from, let's say, 4 years ago until today. So 4 years ago is when Facebook became the most widely visited website on the planet. More people visited Facebook than Google, Yahoo, WLRN.org. I know it's hard to believe.
Oh, I can't imagine.
But there was so much information that was being shared that the evidence that was in a tweet or in a Facebook post or in an Instagram post was starting to pop up in court. And the judges had to decide, are we going to rely upon this social media evidence as a fact when we have a trial? And so initially, judges were very hesitant to allow social media evidence to get into court. there's a legal evidentiary rule called authenticity, meaning that whatever document, whatever piece of evidence that you're offering to the court, you have to establish is the true and correct version or copy of that document or that piece of evidence. And because I can create within 2 minutes of time a social media profile for you, Bonnie, by just creating an email address, finding your photograph online, starting a Facebook profile, and then start making posts, judges were very weary about whether or not we are going to allow this type of evidence to be used in court.
With good reason.
Definitely. So the courts have had to modify these existing evidentiary rules, for example, authenticity, that was designed to address a paper document or an email and now apply it to social media. And so the court looks to see, is the evidence that is being offered reliable? Meaning, is it what it purports to be? And attorneys have a responsibility to help the court understand that the evidence or the social media post that they want to rely on is actually coming from the particular person that they're saying it's from. Now, in the instance of President Trump, this issue is easy.
Right.
He's tweeting 100 times a day right. from his account, and he is unabashedly saying that this is mine.
Right.
And so it's much easier for a tweet to get into court, and his recent tweet did impact his proposed immigration policy and his revised travel ban.
That it was a Muslim ban instead of a travel ban.
Exactly. The administration went into the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and said this is part of the president's evidentiary power and, you know, ignore the tweets. This is just the president blowing off steam. This is really a limited immigration ban, not a Muslim ban. And of course, the opponents to the bill themselves took the tweet and blew it up in a giant poster board. And it says, this is a Muslim ban. I'm the president of the United States, and this is what I want to stop so I can protect America. And the judges relied upon this because that tweet was from the president. It was easily authenticated, and therefore it could have been considered as part of the trial. And it
just
was
as though it were in a news conference.
Exactly.
And what about, okay, so it's hard to authenticate a Facebook thing. I mean, the president's making it very easy to authenticate his tweets, right? What about a YouTube video? Is that admissible?
It definitely can be. So what we have to do is we have to use two different types of evidentiary procedures to get a YouTube video or some other social media evidence into court. The first way that we can do it is through testimony. So let's say that we wanted to introduce Joe's YouTube video. And if we put Joe on the stand and said, Joe, is this your YouTube page? He said, yes, it is. How do you know that this is your page? Well, I created it 2 years ago. I post videos once a week, and this is my photo, or excuse me, my video. The judge is going to allow that type of evidence to come in because we have someone with personal knowledge who's saying that this is my YouTube video. But oftentimes, it's the opposing party trying to get the video in, and the account holder themselves is not going to cooperate because
right.
they don't want that evidence to be
right.
used against them.
Right.
So now there are many different companies who collect what's called the metadata, the invisible data behind the YouTube video that helps to establish that the video is what it purports to be, meaning we can find the IP address, the location of where it was posted, the date and time that it was posted from,
but
and
can't
the account.
What's that called when you can say you're somewhere else? What's that called?
By using our, you know, GPS or location.
But you can mirroring?
Or?
No, you can change your location. You can say you're in England. I could say right now I'm in England doing something. I forget what it's called, though, on the computer.
Yes.
But you can change your IP address.
You can, in certain circumstances, do so. And in fact, when I'm posting on social media, for example, I was in Europe a few weeks ago. And we went on a wonderful trip to London, and I wanted to post about the trip, but I was back here in Miami. And I was able on my Facebook account to say, even though Facebook says, aren't you in Miami? I said, no, I put London as my location. But even if I change that on Facebook, there are forensic investigators who would be able to take my phone and say, no, even though I've changed the location on Facebook to say that I was somewhere else, they can tell based upon the GPS technology in your phone where that particular post was made or that video was created.
It's a VPN. The VPN where you can say you're in London and people will say you're in London.
Yes, virtual something or other.
Yeah, I forget what, I can look up what it stands for, but you can do that.
You can, and that's the game that we are playing. It's a giant cat and mouse game.
But if it's
game.
A big issue, they can get the truth.
Exactly. And so we've got, on the one hand, technology advancing so much faster than the law can adapt. And so we always have people who are trying to game the system and say, what can I do to make it more difficult to find the evidence,
right.
more difficult to get it into court? And this is just going to be one more legal barrier that attorneys will have to overcome when they try to get this information into evidence.
We had, talking about the fake news thing, there was this article that Richard gave us. It was by Mark A. Cohen. Do you know him? In writing in Forbes?
Yes.
And the name of the byline, the name of the title was Law in the Age of Social Media, Mark Cohen. And his conclusion about what's real and what's not real in the judicial system, he says, the impact of social media is profound. Left without filters, social media poses a threat to any society governed by the rule of law. Lawyers, the guardians of the rule of law, must fight to ensure this does not happen. The distinction between fact and fiction is critical, not only to lawyers, but also to a free society, all in a free society. So he's saying social media, it's up to those bodies to actually govern it and filter it, right?
That's one of the ways that he's looking at addressing the issue. And why is this such a big deal? We have in the United States a system of juries who are designed to determine what is fact and what is fiction. They're going to listen to testimony, they're going to consider evidence that's presented in court, and they're going to decide who they believe and who's guilty and who's innocent. The problem is that jurors can now reach into their mobile phone.
Yeah, how can you impanel a fair juror,
fair and impartial jury? This was a circumstance that we're seeing right now with the Bill Cosby trial. We had a mistrial because we had people.
It's been in the news for years.
Exactly. How has anyone not heard of Bill Cosby and the issue and created some sort of impression in their mind, whether it's, oh, he's guilty, there's no way he didn't do it.
Or Huxtable would never do that.
Or Huxtable would never do that. And so while we can have instructions to our jurors to say don't view social media, it's very difficult to actually enforce that at the end of the day. And so as more social media, quote unquote, news is released, it becomes more and more difficult to limit what our jurors can consider and how that's going to impact the judicial system.
Let's take a call. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. First up, Jeff, Fort Lauderdale. Let's talk about YouTube. Jeff, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. While I was on hold, I may have missed you talking about YouTube a little bit, but I was wondering when people have these vlogs on YouTube, and sometimes they will represent themselves as an expert or they might even look at several different products, comparing one product to another product and making representations. I was wondering how the law viewed that sort of an approach. And even more specifically, recently, there was a YouTube video vlog where one person was interviewing somebody else as a quote-unquote expert who was delivering opinions about tax, rather complicated tax questions, and really, I know them to be totally false, but wondered how the law would view those kinds of things. Can those people who post those blogs actually be sued, or can the people representing it be sued, and do they have to also let other people know if they're receiving some sort of compensation for making a video review between products and favoring one for another? Thank you.
Okay.
Jeff, that is one of the biggest issues that we're seeing in the area of social media law today, which is when someone makes a review or endorsement of a product, such as creating a YouTube video to say how great this new widget is, to what extent does this person need to disclose that they have received this product for free or somehow been paid or are an employee of the company that somehow affects their review? This area of law is called truth in advertising, and the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has been cracking down on people who are making reviews of particular products and services, and also what we call social media influencers, which would be someone like your tax expert, for example, who might be hired by, say, QuickBooks to say how wonderful their tool is, but they're not telling people that they work for QuickBooks or have been paid by QuickBooks. And so there's a whole area of law that's developing right now that is requiring both influencers and reviewers to clearly and conspicuously disclose any connection they have with the product or service that they are reporting on.
I think
on.
He was talking maybe, though, about liability also. If I watch some idiot on YouTube tell me how to repair my cruise control on the car, and then I crash the car, is that guy liable at all for putting those notions in my head?
You know, it's not the first time this has happened. There was a woman who sued Google because she used Google Maps and said that the directions took her across the street directly into a river.
And I mean, that's a ridiculous example, but somebody
but
could
what happened
follow
with
those
it?
Directions.
It was thrown out.
It was thrown out.
Okay.
And I think the same type of situation would happen here. And so just like when we came back on the air from this segment and Joe said that any information that Ethan provides as an attorney is for informational purposes only, and the same thing is likely going to apply online, meaning in order for there to be a lawsuit that you provided misinformation, there must be some sort of duty between the person who's delivering the video and the person who claims that they are harmed.
Being consideration.
And doesn't there also have to be intent?
There would be. And so the distinction between the two situations is as follows. If I come into that tax person's office and I hire this tax person to give me tax advice, and that tax advice is incorrect and I'm harmed as a result of it, I would have a lawsuit for negligence against that person giving the tax advice because that person owed me a duty. They had a responsibility to me, their client, to provide.
It would be fiduciary then.
Right.
Exactly, the correct information. This situation doesn't match up on YouTube, meaning someone who's giving helpful videos about tax advice doesn't have a particular duty.
It's assumed
to
the viewer
the
will take
end.
A grain of salt to somebody who's. Okay, Jeff, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, I would just add to that when you talk about going into the water. My mother always said, if somebody jumped off the cliff into the water, should you do it?
Told you to, right. Okay, right. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye. I just want to follow up. The VPN, I was trying to say you can pretend you're somewhere else. Okay, so a VPN is a virtual private network. It allows you to create a secure connection to another network over the internet. VPNs can be used to access region-restricted websites, shield your browsing activity from prying eyes on public Wi-Fi, and more.
And defeat blocks and things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
This is happening in these file sharing type lawsuits where people are downloading copyrighted material like movies or books, and they are changing their IP address
right.
through the VPN to make it more difficult for the copyright owner to track them down.
Okay, we're going to take another break, talking with attorney Ethan Wall, Social Media Law and Order. We'll be right back.
And we're back 37 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and social media attorney Ethan Wall. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576. Ethan, back to paid endorsements by influencers. Last time we talked about the story of Pitbull. Why don't you retell that story and how that panned out?
Absolutely. So Pitbull was promoting the Visit Florida promotion. He was hosting...
The rapper.
Exactly. Pitbull is a big, big production artist, and he's right here from Miami. And everybody who knows Pitbull knows that he loves and he cares about Miami. And so he put on a concert and an entire promotion that was all about the Visit Florida campaign, was to get people to come here and experience all the wonderful things that Pitbull experiences here in Florida. What people didn't know is that Pitbull wasn't just promoting the Visit Florida campaign out of the kindness of his heart. Mm-hmm. He was also paid, I think, around $1 million to promote the concert itself and come visit Florida by the state of Florida. And people sued to say we wanted to know how much money he was getting, who was he getting, because it wasn't clear from his social media advertisements that he was actually being paid to promote the Visit Florida campaign. And so this brings a whole new issue to the forefront, which is truth in advertising. If I leave a review about a product or service, it's going to influence the people within my network. They will be more likely to buy a product that I think is great if I say wonderful things about it because they know me and they trust me and they think the reviews are okay. But it's also going to affect people's opinion if they knew that I was paid to give that review. So if I don't clearly and conspicuously disclose the fact that I am an influencer or that I'm being paid or that this is an ad or that I receive free product or some sort of an incentive, then both I and the company that hired me might violate the truth in advertising laws, which are currently being enforced in a big, big way by the FTC.
What about on Amazon? You know, someone goes and reviews it. Well, it turns out they work for that company, you know.
Or they've been given
made
the product.
They've been given that. Right. And I mean, how do they find out that that person was given the product or has an interest in the company or owns stock in the company or whatever the case?
A few years ago, there was a really big crackdown on these fake online Amazon reviews. There would be companies that people would pay for. And I have a new product, and they'd said, pay us money, and we will have 10, 20, 30, 40 people leave a positive five-star review because people know that once you have a lot of five-star reviews, you're more likely to buy your product than someone who doesn't. But these reviews were fake. And so the FTC and others were cracking down, not on the individuals themselves because it was so difficult to track down who they are for the same reasons that we talked about with the VPN. Instead, they went after the companies themselves, either the ones that were buying the fake reviews or the companies that were supplying the fake reviews. And so now we've transitioned from these five-star fake Amazon reviews to the issue of social media influencers, meaning people like Kim Kardashian, Jennifer Lopez, Kylie Jenner, they are being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to create one social media post that promotes a product or service. And it might be, oh my gosh, I love this wonderful skincare product that I have. It makes
hair dryer.
Me glow. Right. Or I'm going to go to, you know, this hotel. It's a place that I always stay. And there might be a photograph of them, you know, laying on the bed. And their thousands or millions, excuse me, of followers are going to see this. And there's a ton of brand value. But they are not, and sometimes, using the appropriate disclosure, saying that this is an ad, that they were paid for it. And so what the FTC has now done is send 100 letters to some of the most prominent influencers like Kim Kardashian, Jennifer Lopez, even Allen Iverson, the old 76ers basketball player, who have, in the FTC's eyes, violated these rules. And what they want to do is put the influencers on notice, saying not only are you violating the law, but also the companies that are paying you. And so if you don't start doing this correctly, then we're going to come after you for a violation of the FTC.
And when you say they're going to go after them, what does that mean?
That means that there could be fines as large as $50,000 per post. And so if an influencer is only getting paid $20,000 to create a post, but they can be fined $50,000 to do so, they're going to dry up the influencer market because they don't want to take that risk. And so some companies right now, like Xbox and Lord & Taylor and Sony, have had an FTC charge against either them or a marketing company that they use to hire influencers to demonstrate that they're not complying with the particular laws and regulations.
Lord & Taylor. Mm-hmm. Do they still exist?
They exist. And you might see what I'll call these Instagram models that will post these photographs of themselves out and about in a beautiful location and wearing the Lord & Taylor clothes. And their followers will then buy those different outfits. And so there's a requirement on people like Lord & Taylor that if they're going to hire influencers, they must instruct them as to what the disclosures are, how to post the disclosure in a conspicuous way, meaning front and center, not hidden when you have to say, see more, to scroll down, you know, a particular page, and also monitor their influencers to make sure that if they're going to be hiring someone who has a lot of influential power, that the company and the influencer themselves are going to be responsible for making sure that the correct disclosures are used so that the public is protected and they can make informed decisions about what their celebrities love or don't love. Because if a celebrity loves a product and they want to promote it and they're not getting anything in return, that's totally okay.
Right, right.
It's once there's money behind it, people deserve to know that they were getting paid for that post.
Well, I hope I didn't offend anybody with the Lord and Taylor. I just thought they closed a store. They're still a brick and mortar store, and I didn't mean to offend
anybody.
All
right, let's go back to the phones. Let's have Greg in Boca. You're up, Greg. Hi.
Hi. The term you were looking for was not really VPN, but proxy server. What that does is pretend that the person is located in Australia or Germany or wherever, instead of where they're actually located. It's routing their internet traffic through that computer located wherever it is.
Okay.
VPNs can use proxy servers.
Okay.
But VPNs, virtual private network, primary function is to encrypt traffic, particularly from a public site like a hotspot, so that somebody sitting nearby also on wireless can't try to read passwords or account numbers and things.
Okay, we
okay,
get it.
Greg.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
We got to hire Greg.
Yeah, Greg, we're going to. Yeah. Okay. We're going to take our last break on today's Topical Current, speaking with attorney Ethan Wall, Social Media Law and Order. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Current, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and social media attorney Ethan Wall. We're having a good time this afternoon. And we have lots of calls. We have emails. And we'll begin with Dave in Miami. Dave, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A little comment on fake news. I am a school teacher, and a person very near and dear to me told me to be careful because, and this was about a year ago, that President Barack Obama was fining people $8,000 for reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in class. And I said, this isn't true. I mean, I ought to know. I would have received an order not to do it. He said, oh, let me show you. Let me show you. And he shows me the ad, and I said, this can't be. And I showed him where the logo for ABC News was totally wrong, oval instead of round, wrong script. And then I open up my email, and I said, look, there is no order here. This is not real. Well, I'll have to look into that. I'll have to check and see, because I'm very well informed with my news from the internet. That's the way it stayed.
Right.
Yeah.
You can show them the evidence. It's fake news. It's clear. They're going to believe what they want to believe.
Well, that's true, Ethan.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
You know,
that is true,
Thank
Dave.
You.
And if you keep repeating false information, it tends to get more weight to it.
Of course.
And the old Joseph Goebbels thing.
This is a prime example of intentional fake news. And as Dave said, some people really believe this stuff. And so what is Facebook doing now in connection with these intentional fake news sites? So why is there intentional fake news anyway? Meaning, what's the incentive for someone to put that Barack Obama is going to fine you $8,000. He's got he's got his eyeballs on you through the chalkboard.
Bernie Sanders runs a house of prostitution.
Exactly.
Or the Hillary Clinton with the pizza, the prostitution ring.
Right.
Thing.
Hillary Clinton running a child pornography ring out of a pizza joint in Washington, D.C. I mean, this has got to be false, and it's designed to be false. So why do people do it in the first place? It's not really to create a ruse with Dave's colleague, although that was a result of the fake news, because people will see it on the internet and it appears to be from an authoritative source. The reason they do it is all about the money, meaning there are websites that are created that simply create fake news and share the article on social media and then will boost through the advertising revenue this particular post so a lot of people see it. And every time somebody clicks on Facebook, back to the fake news story itself, that website is making money from advertisers who pay to display ads on the website.
What kind of money are we talking about? Do you have any idea?
Big money. And that's why we see so many of these sites doing it. And they will create names like the Miami Observer or U.S. News and Times, something that might have the indicia of reliability and authenticity, when really someone just bought a domain name that sounds good, made up a whole bunch of malarkey, and is rolling in the dough. And so what Facebook is trying to do is, once they identify these serial fake news websites, that they are working with Google to stop at their pocketbooks, meaning to prevent these people from making ad revenue through Facebook and Google, and therefore removing the incentive, and then removing those intentional fake news sites.
But isn't this actionable? I mean, can't these people, aren't they liable for something?
Yeah, but we have to then call Greg to find out where these people are located because they're using the proxies and the VPNs.
And many of them have multiple clicks on
and we don't know even their names. Like, we don't know anything.
Something like the shocking truth behind the set on the set of the Beverly Hillbillies or something like that to get keep you on there as long as possible to learn more about Ellie Mae. And
right. And that's the thing is once you shut down one website, this guy's going to create a new domain and do another one. And so instead of trying to track down the person and have a lawsuit against someone that might be located in Pakistan or India or somewhere that would be difficult for us to locate, let alone enforce the law, instead we're going to stop with the money. Because if these people aren't making money off the fake news sites, then there's no incentive for them to do it, and that would limit it. And then we're going to limit the amount of quote-unquote fake news that we have to consider because we're getting rid of some of the serial offenders.
Okay, I want to move along. Can we do that to this? Because this is pretty shocking. In an 8-0 ruling, SCOTUS strikes down sex offender social media ban. So I think that's so surprising. First of all, if they agreed on anything. And secondly, that they would do that. So explain the context I'm talking about and the ramifications.
North Carolina created a law that would not allow a sex offender to be on social media. They said that we have reasonable laws in place that would prohibit a registered sex offender from being within a certain distance of places that you're likely to find children, such as schools or the mall or playgrounds. And they extended this law to social media themselves.
And that's where most of the trolling happens.
Very much so. But there's also a lot of news that's shared, fake or new. There's the ability to communicate with other people, meaning there's more uses on Facebook than just the ability to potentially reach out to a child. And so there was one registered sex offender from the state of North Carolina that sued, saying the law was unconstitutional and violated his right to free speech.
He was convicted of statutory rape.
That's correct. And while North Carolina didn't agree, the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, and as Bonnie said, in a unanimous decision, which is incredibly unusual, especially in today's decisive day and age where you have both conservative and liberal right. judges on the court, came down in the favor of free speech. And they said that while, of course, there is a huge incentive for us to stop sex offenders from going after children, and we don't want to put them in any place where there's a physical possibility of them approaching children, that stopping them from communicating on a broader platform would be a clear infringement of free speech because it's not tailored specifically for children. If there was a website that would have been tailored just for teens or just for kids, I think that it would be a different scenario because there would be a nexus or a connection between the prohibition and the potential harm. But to stop people from using social media, even if they've committed a very terrible crime like statutory rape, was too much for the U.S. Supreme Court. And in a unanimous decision, cited for the First Amendment.
Do people have to be careful with copyrights on blogs and on Facebook?
Definitely. One of the biggest issues that we see from time to time is someone says, I found the image on Google, therefore I've got the permission to use it on my blog or on my website. And people are surprised to learn they're dead wrong. Just because something can be found through a Google image search doesn't mean that you have permission to use it. And in fact, there are many photographers and artists and people who own the rights to these content who are now hiring attorneys to send demand letters to people who write blogs that use other people's images and are demanding money or threatening a lawsuit for copyright infringement.
And they have their IP address or can get it.
Exactly, because if it's someone's blog, usually they have their name posted, they have their website. They want people to know who they are because they want them to read their content and then hire them for something or think of them as an authority or for a particular area or have an advertiser put their ads on their website. So it's much easier in the instance of someone who writes a blog to find out who that person is, because normally what the attorneys will do is then just email the demand letter to the email address that's on the blog itself.
Now, I just read from Mark Cohn's piece in Forbes, right? But if I had just said that, if I had made that statement and had it, had not quoted Mark Cohn and given him the credit for making, for writing that, would I be liable for something?
Well, you wouldn't be liable for something because we're talking about it in a news setting. We're reporting on what someone said and asking for someone's commentary.
Now, I think they use the term bona fide news setting.
Exactly. So let's change the facts a little bit. Let's say that instead of repeating what he said verbatim on a news show, instead you copied it and put it into your book, or copied it and put it into a guide that you were then selling online to people about social media law, and you didn't provide him any credit, you didn't quote him, and you took it for your own. You could definitely be responsible for copyright infringement. What a lot of people don't know is that someone owns a copyright to something that they draw or write the moment that they're done drawing or writing it. You don't have to go to the United States Copyright Office and file for copyright registration.
So you automatically own it?
Yes.
Even if it's not published.
Even if it's not published. So I could take this pencil right here that I have in front of me, and I can draw the worst stick figure in history and put some smiley faces on it, and I own what's called a common law copyright to that picture. And so that if someone who has knowledge of that photo, which is you, Bonnie, or you, Joe, then take that stick figure or something very similar to it and try to profit off of it, I would have potentially an action for copyright infringement against you. What I would do is then go to the Copyright Office and file for copyright registration retroactively and then come back and say, okay, I now have registered the copyright and therefore I have a right under U.S. copyright law to file a lawsuit against you, and I am entitled to two different types of damages. One, any amount of money that I lost by virtue of you copying the stick figure. And two, any amount of money you gain. Made. So what's the incentive for an artist to then file for copyright registration in the first place? The incentive is that they don't have to prove that, one, you actually saw the stick figure. Instead, your knowledge is presumed by virtue of the fact that I've registered it with the Copyright Office. And two, I don't have to prove that I lost a penny or that you gained a penny. There's something called statutory damages, which means the law is going to allow me to recover money from you simply by virtue of you copying something that I went through the process of registering with the Copyright Office. And when I send a demand letter to you for thousands of dollars and your attorney reviews it and says, look, Bonnie, he followed the law. He has a copyright registration. If he went to court, he could get $25,000 from you. You better pay him the $1,000, $2,000 he's asking now because he knows that he's going to win if he has to go to court, but he's going to make some money on the side from you copying my work of
and
art.
And profiting off of it.
Exactly.
That's the operative term, right?
All right.
Well, I'm sorry we've run out of time because this is always so fascinating. Ethan Wall is an author, attorney, social media legal expert, consultant, and adjunct professor of social media and the law at Nova Southeastern University. He's the founder of the social media law firm, and he's also an author. And his website, socialmedialawandorder.com. And also, he has a great nonprofit, letsplantaseed.com, which is a way of discovering your passions in life. Ethan, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
It's been fun. And that wraps up today's program. Apologies to those callers and emailers we couldn't get on the air. Our lead producer, Richard Ive, technical direction from online content producer Jason Zabka. Holly Landis is associate producer. And of course, we always have free audio archives available. Downloads are linked at our website, WLRN.org. We have a Topical Currents Facebook page as well as an iTunes podcast. No copyright involved for these. Well, maybe there are.
Maybe there are.
Tomorrow's program is both informative and pledge-friendly. We'll have the Topical Currents version of our end-of-fiscal-year mini-drive plus Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. And we'll all have a good time talking about the Rusty Pelican Restaurant on Biscayne Bay. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.